В Лондоне скончался Борис Березовский, беглого российского
олигарха. Запрета пропаганды гомосексуализма.
Жители западного Бирюлева. Обычные москвичи.
President seemed to disappear from the scene, only to steal the show in the final act. An oligarch passed away, but the system he pioneered lives on. An opposition blogger found his voice and became a political force. Nationalism went mainstream, the culture wars intensified. New words and phrases entered the political lexicon, like, for example, quote, non-traditional sexual relations, end quote, sparking often hilarious discussions about what that might mean. And protest acts got more creative, sometimes painfully so. And as the year wrapped up, three of Russia's most famous political prisoners finally walked free. It's certainly been a roller coaster, albeit one that is not moving in any clear direction. But we'll try to make some sense out of it for you anyway. Hello from our studios in Prague, and welcome to a special year-end edition of the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much, Brian. Welcome to you.
And Happy New Year and Happy Holidays and all of that stuff. To get the ball rolling, let's be cliche and let's ask something boring and predictable. 2013 was the year of what in Russia? How would you characterize the year that's just wrapping up?
Well, it's tempting to say it's the year of bits and pieces, because precisely as you characterize it, all kinds of things would happen. But in some ways, let me try and tease out a meta theme beyond that. Precisely because it was the year of bits and pieces, I think it was the year in which actually Putin failed. And I know it's easy enough to be sort of making these claims when you know you're not going to have an instant sort of reality check. But I think it's basically the year that showed that the Putin system has lost its creative capacities. And as with all these processes, it's not going to be instant. You know, if we think of how long it took the Soviet Union to run down. But nonetheless, I think precisely because the Putin regime, call it what you will, hasn't managed to create some kind of narrative for 2013, it's very much, I think, showed its failings.
Well, I think that it's interesting that you chose to focus on Putin, because this is one of the first things I wanted to discuss about this year. Putin was largely invisible for most of it. Mm-hmm. But then at the end of the year, suddenly he burst on the scene and was winning one foreign policy victory after another. And he closed out the year with quite a bang with the Khodorkovsky pardon and the amnesty for Pussy Riot. I want to play a couple of cuts that, to me, in a lot of ways, This was the most notable thing Putin did during the year until his big crescendo at the end. And let's listen to these cuts that I want to have. It's as Putin and his wife Ludmila Putin are speaking in June.
Вся моя деятельность, вся работа связана с публичностью.
All my activities, all the work is done under the eye of the public and constantly looked upon. Some people like this, some people don't. There are some people who are not comfortable with this at all. Like Людмила Александровна.
This was really our joint decision. Our marriage has been over because of the fact that we practically never see each other. Vladimir Vladimirovich is overwhelmed with work. Our children have grown up. Everyone has their own life now.
Well, that, of course, was Putin and his ex-wife, soon-to-be ex-wife, Ludmila Putina, announcing their divorce on television in June. This was how Putin was making news in these days. And there was talk Putin seemed to be fading from the scene. We didn't talk about him on the podcast for months, if you remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And there was talk about who was going to be Putin's successor. There were active discussions about this that we were writing about on the blog and we were discussing in the podcast. And then at the end of the year, the last few months of the year, he comes back with a bang, right? Brokering a settlement, a settlement in Syria, the convincing Armenia and Ukraine, that's putting it very politely, to abandon their European ambitions, the Khodorkovsky pardon, the Pussy Riot amnesty, and suddenly Putin's supposedly back on top of his game. He's the most influential person in the world, according to Forbes. He's the leader of the world conservative movement, according to his own image makers. What do you make of this? Was this big resurrection of Putin? And we've discussed this in the past, but you're still convinced this was an illusion. You don't see any kind of Putin resurrection going on right now.
Yeah, you talk about him being back with a bang, but I think this is the difference between artillery and fireworks. you know, it's actually, well, you know, what is the real impact? And I mean, I thought it was delightful that you used the Lyudmila clip. I mean, you know, let's face it, Lyudmila was the official reason why she's divorcing Putin is basically because she doesn't see that much of him and they've grown apart. Well, I can't help feeling that Russia must feel much the same way. The thing about Putin is, yes, there's suddenly been, you know, he's suddenly in the news. But 2 points really about that. One is, these are almost entirely foreign policy issues. And let's face it, foreign policy very rarely strengthens your domestic position. One could ask Mikhail Gorbachev about that one. If anything, actually, a concentration on foreign policy is often one of the ways in which leaders retreat from failure at home. Because foreign policy is so much easier that the levers are close to hand. You can seem to have an instant impact in a way that, I don't know, diversifying national infrastructure, you know, is so much more intractable and frankly boring. So I think reason number one is actually we shouldn't think that foreign policy means anything in particular. Point number two is, you know, you talked about, you know, sort of releasing political prisoners and so forth. He's playing quite high-value cards. You know, you can only release Khodorkovsky once.
Well, unless you rearrest him.
For his sake, quite. But one has to ask, okay, but what did he win as a result? He won headlines, briefly. But there's no real signs yet, and okay, we wait and see, but there's no real signs yet that sort of the opposition is saying, good Lord, we were wrong about that nice Mr. Putin, or that the sort of the masses are coming out in crowds to thank Putin for releasing Pussy Riot or whatever. I mean, I think one has to come back to the point of, well, what actually is he managing to achieve? And here I do think that this is a year, and this is one reason why at the beginning I was talking about the Putin regime rather than Putin, because precisely I think Putin himself actually has not only been relatively invisible domestically this year, I think he's also been relatively ineffective this year.
Mm-hmm. You don't see, I interpreted the releases the pardon of Khodorkovsky and the inclusion of Pussy Riot members in the amnesty as a sign of confidence on Putin's part at this point. He feels like he can afford to do this now. Did you not see it as a sign of, or is it perhaps misplaced confidence?
I don't think so. Again, I think it's something that I sort of mentioned in the previous one, is that my sense of Putin is that this is not a man who, when he feels comfortable and confident, feels the need to be magnanimous. Actually, you know, he has been far, far stronger in the past and has not released Khodorkovsky or whatever. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think this is a man who only does these things because he feels they're necessary. Precisely, they are an easy and quick way to once again seem to be powerful, seem to be able to do something. And again, even just the way it was choreographed. Again, it was that sort of, you know, journalist question, the Tsar speaks, and mm-hmm. suddenly, bang, it's happened, and Khodorkovsky is on a plane to Germany. You know, it's all trying to emphasize that sort of patriarchal, patrimonial, unchallenged rule of one man. And the whole point is, when you have to stress that, it actually says something about your need to do so. I mean, if I was going to look for reasons for suggesting that Putin actually has been achieving something, it wouldn't be looking at the Khodorkovskys. I wrote a little piece for Russia magazine trying to look for good news for Russia. And I think when one looks at, well, what actually could be said to be successful signs of the future, it's things like the beginnings of a slightly more serious anti-corruption campaign, mm-hmm. You know, which rhetorically we see every single year. But I think this year we have begun to see it happen more in reality. It's things like that. It's actually where real success needs to be made is institutionally. And that is not going to be addressed by foreign policy triumphs, let alone by one-off big propaganda coups or whatever. It's a question of whether Putin is willing to really engage with the country.
Right. Now, I also think there's another larger issue here. If you look at Putin's numbers, or at least look at the Levada Center, which are the most reliable numbers out there on Putin, his popularity is in the 40s. And you might say, well, that's fine. Obama's popularity is in the 40s, right? I don't know where David Cameron's popularity is, but maybe it's in the 40s is fine for an ordinary president in a democratic polity. You can govern with those kind of numbers. But to govern the way Putin wants to govern, the czar for life, you had better have numbers up into the 70s like he had during his first two terms in the Kremlin. In order to rule the way he wants to rule, you really have to have more than half, and certainly more than 40% of the, much more than half, and certainly more than 40% of the society behind you. And I guess going back to your original point, this is the year that Putin failed, despite appearances to the contrary at the end of the year. I don't see any way of him, given the how divided Russian society is and much of society clamoring for a new leader and a new type of leader, I don't see him ever getting back to those kinds of numbers again. I think this is the new normal for him. First, I would say, do you agree with that? And second, can he govern the way he wants to govern with these kinds of numbers?
Point one, I agree with you completely that this is not the basis on which a sort of a Putinist sort of czarist structure can be managed, because those sort of figures of popularity in the 40s represent the situation when there is no credible rival. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, if you look at the Obamas and the Camerons and the Merkels, their popularity figures are always comparative ones.
Right.
Anyway, this is more just like a plebiscite. On mm-hmm. do you like the status quo? So yeah, I agree.
Well, that's pretty damning if you're only getting in the 40s in a plebiscite.
Well, precisely. I mean, and I think this is why to an extent Putin is locked into a situation. Look, could he possibly do something about it? Well, one has to think. Well, okay, what actually would dramatically change his numbers in likelihood? One would be some great renewed economic bonanza. Like the early Putin years. But again, if we look at the economy, I mean, they're continuing to downgrade the expectations for economic growth in the coming year.
No, it's going in the opposite direction, yeah.
Exactly. It's clear that Russia has some hard times ahead, and to say nothing of the sort of, long, deep-seated issues of over-dependence on hydrocarbons, poor infrastructure, regions in debt, that kind of thing. So that deus ex machina ain't going to happen. The second option is that Putin manages to change the basis of his rule. And I think in some ways, things like the anti-corruption campaign that I mentioned sort of represent some sort of potential for it. Putin had always historically presented himself as the czar who can keep the boyars in check. Now, in practice, he was nothing of the sort. But again, if he wants to reconstruct himself in that way, he's basically going to have to take on the elite. And that's going to be a really dangerous struggle. And again, we've seen nothing to suggest that Putin has the willingness to take risks that mm-hmm. that would entail. So again, I think that's potentially there, but unlikely. The third option is some external threat that makes people rally round. Again, we're now thinking back to apartment bombs and mm-hmm. the evil Chechen and so forth. And I don't see anything like that. I mean, because in some ways, the obvious thing would be, for example, if there was some catastrophic attack on Sochi. But then you'd have to sort of play the potential rallying cry factor against the deep, deep humiliation, given the extent to which Putin has made this a sort of a personal project. So again, I think unless the Chinese are going to obligingly try and annex Vladivostok or something, I don't see a real threat. And again, I think in part this is one of the reasons why there is this increasing nationalism, this increasing sense of that we are being assailed by foreign cosmopolitan values. But I just don't think that's got a lot of traction. So in a way, I don't see what Putin can do to change the numbers. Now, the flip side is, and I'm rambling on, but the flip side is, I mean, it's not that at the moment he's imminently in danger.
Yeah.
My view is, though, it means that there's a brittleness. Navalny was able to get 27% in the Moscow mayoral elections. That was, a true achievement, despite the low turnout. At present, there is no obvious alternative candidate who is also able to marshal some kind of a political machine, get his word out or whatever. But we know how quickly things can change. I mean, for me, that is the issue, is that Putin at present is in a stable but brittle situation. Right. He's like the person who's wired into all the machines on life support. There's no imminent expectation that they're going to die, but who knows if some new virus is going to suddenly creep into the system and then suddenly, bang, everything could be different.
Right. Well, you mentioned Navalny, and you've anticipated me because that's the next person who was in the news for much of the year, and we want to talk about him a little bit now. So let's listen to a clip from Alexei Navalny, his speaking at the closing statement during his fraud trial back in July.
I declare that my colleagues and I will do everything to destroy the feudal system that is being established in Russia, to destroy this system of power in which 83% of the country's wealth is in the hands of half of 1% of the population.
These were heady times for Navalny. That was the day he was convicted. But nevertheless, these were heady times for Navalny. If you go from his trial in the summer to the Moscow mayoral election in September, he certainly had the feel of something that was rising, right? Of a political force. At the time, it seemed like an unstoppable political force. And then Navalny sort of disappeared. I mean, we're not hearing much from or about Navalny since this. What do you make of that?
Well, part of me is tempted to make an entirely sort of ridiculous conspiracy theory. Say, isn't it funny how Putin rises when Navalny disappears? Have we ever seen them in the same room together? Again, I mean, I think it has been interesting. And I think in part it's a reflection of the fact that, I mean, it's in part a reflection of the fact that winter is generally a time when a lot of politics sort of hunkers down. But also I think it's that Navalny, because he hasn't institutionalized his opposition, he doesn't have a machine. Instead, he has events, and he proved phenomenally good at capitalizing on those events. I mean, even if we think of just the way this opposition movement sort of was galvanized by the castling, he didn't create that, but in some ways that created him.
Yeah.
And likewise, the mayoral elections were a perfect opportunity for him to get his word out to at least a part of the sort of potential constituency. His trial also was a great event. And I think, in a way, the point is that Navalny hasn't at the moment either been able to manufacture or capitalize on any obvious events. So I think unless and until he manages to find a way of building a political platform, and there's this constant talk of sort of creating a political party, but exactly that's all it is, it's talk really. Until he manages to do that, he will continue to be dependent on a suitable pretext, a suitable platform emerging, at which point he can jump up and deploy the phenomenal skills he has of essentially marketing himself, marketing his message, and speaking in permanent and effective soundbites.
Right. Well, there was an interesting... His name popped up in the news, it was a couple of weeks ago, when Sergei Mitrokhin, the head of Yabloko, said that Navalny is an oligarchic project, and we are going to fight this oligarchic project. It caused enough waves in the little bubble of opposition land that Yavlinsky kind of had to step in and kind of clarify it. But what Mitrokhin was talking about was that Navalny was allegedly being financed by the Alpha Group. And, You know, I've always wondered, we go back to this old meme of when Alexei meets Alexei, the metaphor of the Alexei Kudrin, Alexei Navalny. But this is Navalny and the elite, so to speak, Navalny and the technocratic side of the elite. You know, you have to wonder if this is just another phase of the Navalny project. Do you see something like that? I mean, what I'm getting at is kind of Navalny as a project of the technocratic side of the elite, whether or not it's the alpha group or not is immaterial, but that there is a hand behind all of this. This isn't just Navalny being a good campaigner, a good marketer of himself and his message. Do you see some deeper game possibly being going on?
Yeah, well, actually, let me sort of go to my classic meme, yes and no. I don't see Navalny as a pure project. That implies a grand strategy and so forth, and I'm not convinced there is that. I mean, clearly, Navalny is not the outsider who comes in from the wilderness. Frankly, these people, you know, people who are challengers rarely do. Yeltsin was an old Communist Party hack before he reinvented himself. Well, likewise, I mean, you know, if you even think back to the whole discussion about, you know, when Navalny was being brought onto the board of Aeroflot. You know, this is clearly a man who operates within fairly rarefied elite circles, who can play those games. The people around him, and obviously sort of Ashurkov, is very much seen as the sort of the link man between him and the Alpha Empire. Yeah, I mean, I think it's not, I think, that people sat down and said, we need to sort of, in Frankenstein's monster style, build an opposition leader. I think it's more that, you know, within the oligarchs, and exactly particularly the sort of the technocratic wing, there is a sense of building insurance. You know, you never rely on just one Krisha.
Right.
You know, you always have multiple people who can protect you and look after you and pass you information and so forth. And certainly, you know, if I was a rich Russian, particularly of the brand who is not entirely dependent upon Putin and direct state money, i.e., you know, not a Sechin, let's say. You know, one of the things I'd be wanting to do is to make sure that I diversified my options, that I was certainly not seen as challenging the Kremlin. That's a very dangerous thing to do. But on the other hand, you know, I'd have no problem with trying to make sure that I maintain channels of communication. And likewise, I think Navalny has no problem with maintaining channels of communication with people within the elite. So again, I mean, I think for me, this is part of the substrate of politics. Not so much, as it were, the deep state, but the crust around the deep state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as sort of, as people see that the current deep state is weak, or potentially becoming weak, they begin to maneuver. You know, are they going to be able to take over the deep state? Are they going to have to find themselves a new deep state? Are they going to have to find themselves a new basis or whatever? I mean, you know, it's part of the general ferment of politics. And therefore, I think that sort of from Navalny's point of view, or, you know, why Navalny is important in this context is precisely that he's a symptom of this willingness to contemplate alternative futures and a desire to try and make sure that you build yourself multiple routes into those futures.
And he's almost like a prototype, if you look at him as a product, the prototype of the kind of leader. If you're saying Putin is the old style leader, the old product, the iPhone 3, if you will, that people want to get rid of, Navalny is almost like the prototype of the whatever the to push the metaphor of the iPhone 5S or whatever, that's a significant portion of the society and part of the elite apparently is clamoring for. And in this sense, can we kind of look at this past year for Navalny as kind of an audition?
I think it's a really nice way of looking at it, and I mean, I agree with you completely about his potential standing as a sort of a prototype, proto-leader. In that, you know, let's face it, Navalny is potentially dangerous to many within the elite, but he's also exceedingly pragmatic. He's business-friendly. He's nationalist, and that's not just simply a code for racist. I mean, it's also, you know, he is clearly a, you know, he believes in Russia. Mm-hmm. He is not a sort of a, you know, a foreign agent or whatever. You know, I mean, he could precisely be a economically liberal but nonetheless nationalistically conservative, modernizing leader that precisely the, you know, a large chunk of the elite could perfectly live with. Some, you know, but the ones who couldn't are the ones who are just so closely tied to Putin that anyway it will be hard to see them being able to survive any major transition of power anyway. So, I mean, in that context, yeah, I mean, we could see this as being sort of an audition. Of course, the question becomes, though, is an audition for which audience? Is the future of Russian politics going to be oligarch-determined? Or, actually, is there going to be a genuine democratization, in which case Navalny still not just hasn't, but doesn't seem that interested in reaching out to a wider constituency? Beyond, again, you know, it's event-driven. Beyond Biryulyeva and his chance to flirt a bit with nationalism then. You know, in a proactive sense, it's hard to see Navalny going and doing that.
He has tried to unify the nationalist and liberal wings of the opposition with varying degrees of success. So,
yeah, but it's a question of reaching out. I mean, again, at the moment, we're talking about a relatively small constituency and an attempt to capture as large a proportion of that. Now, if Navalny or anyone else is actually really going to become a powerful challenge to Putin, rather than just simply waiting for the Putin regime to self-destruct and hope to be able to step in, well, in that case, he needs to move beyond that current constituency, that shall we say, that 20% or 27% that he was able to capture in Moscow.
Well, if we look at this year as an audition, looking at his trial and his mayoral campaign, how do you think he did? I mean, in both contexts, before the public and before the part of the elite he is trying to, or apparently trying to appeal to.
Well, I mean, in terms of the elite, I think he's done very well. I mean, his key challenge was not to be scary, to show that he was sensible, to show that he didn't actually sort of stand for, you know, mass redistribution of wealth, a huge purge of the elite or whatever. I mean, and that he, you know, was an able manager. And I think he's done that pretty well. But on the other hand, I think we come back to this point of actually reaching out to the public. What do most in the public really know about him? I think that in terms of, as it were, if we want to continue this iPhone metaphor, because it makes a change from the Lord of the Rings, you know, again, at present, he is still the high-value 5S. There's no sense of him shifting into 5C mode and trying to sort of acquire a lower-budget demographic. And I think that's
and he has to be able to do
challenge.
That as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, because Putin could do that, you see. I mean, in however sort of crass and however much it was entertaining for us sort of to be able to poke fun at, you know, with his various antics, with his rather crude nationalism, with his championing of the Chechen War and so forth, you know, Putin was able to build for himself a wider constituency. And also that whole image of the paternal czar who would parachute in and solve your local problems and dress down the local boyars, which everyone liked to see. That did work.
Right. And Putin had a much shorter audition time. If you think back to the end of 1999, the beginning of 2000, that all happened very quickly. All right. We've looked at Putin and the main opposition figure. This is all happening in a context. Nationalism went pretty mainstream this year. I mean, it's always mainstream in Russia. But it went super mainstream this year. Immigrants or migrants became a political football. I want to play two clips by two people, both of whom are very important in Moscow to various constituencies, that right in the aftermath of the ethnic violence that erupted in southern Moscow back in October. Let's listen to those two clips now, and you can see if you can tell me who's speaking.
We understand and support the demands of Muscovites to put in order open-air markets, trade warehouses, and to stem illegal immigration, and to improve the performance of the law enforcement authorities. We are ourselves taking active steps in this direction.
Of course, I don't like seeing cars burning or being turned over in the streets of Moscow. But the authorities themselves have sent a clear signal with their inaction over the last couple of days. paving the way for pogroms. They are ignoring killings. They are not investigating anything, but if there is a pogrom, they will fly in a helicopter and arrest everybody.
Well, these were two men who ran against each other for the top job in Moscow, for the Moscow. The first was Sergei Sobyanin, the incumbent mayor of Moscow, and the second, of course, was Mr. Navalny. What struck me about these two cuts and why I chose these two clips is because they're both essentially saying the same thing. Mm. They're both saying pretty. I mean, Navalny's a little more colorful in his language than the staid Sobyanin, but they're essentially saying the same thing. Where do you see this issue going now? Because this is the year it really came to the fore. It was always there, latent below the surface, but the mask really came off this year. To the point where you have, you know, a member of the ruling elite and the leading figure in the opposition basically looking at it exactly the same way.
Yeah, and again, I think this plays back to the fact that sort of politics is in flux. It's one of those sort of empty cliches. But I mean, I think it reflects the fact that, look, nationalism is one of these forces that you can use to try and cohere political support that crosses class boundaries, crosses interest boundaries. It's a way in which the fat cat and the truck driver can feel they're actually part of the same thing in a way that, you know, actually they live in completely different worlds. And therefore, it's often precisely used to glue together fracturing political systems. And that's what we have. I think, again, you know, beneath the surface, there is considerable sort of degree of tectonic pressure breaking the system apart. Mm-hmm. And therefore, people turn to nationalism to try and fix it or to try and sort of hold it together. And therefore, what happens is that the struggle to become the voice of nationalism becomes one of the key political challenges.
Can anybody challenge Navalny on this? I mean, this is his issue. Does he have the upper hand in dealing in this environment?
Well, one could say that this is Putin's issue. I mean, in many ways, Navalny is trying to challenge. I mean, again, now Putin is actually limited in some interesting ways. In that, first of all, you know, he is the state president. He has to work through local elites. Through whether it's the North Caucasus or Tatarstan or wherever. And, you know, he can't turn around and simply just start sort of reviling all non-ethnic Russians or else he has a serious political problem. And in fairness, Putin on the whole has demonstrated him to be a Russian state nationalist rather than necessarily an ethnic Russian nationalist. But nonetheless, I mean, again, I think so this is really the challenge. It's not, as it were, you know, who is the most nationalist. It's whose nationalism. Because in a way, Putin stands for the state nationalism. Navalny is increasingly carving himself out a role as the ethnic nationalist. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, I mean, neither of them can, as it were, effectively park their tanks on the other's turf. So it's more a question of, well, okay, which of these is going to be the most powerful force? And let's face it, I mean, if it's Navalny's kind of nationalism, that is potentially much more dangerous for the Russian Federation and for the cohesion of this country that is, after all, you know, a multi-ethnic country and needs to be a multi-ethnic country. Mm-hmm. If the ethnic Russians genuinely said, okay, we're going to kick out all the quote unquote blacks, who's going to do the work precisely? And indeed, who's going to also serve in your armed forces if you still want to keep your million man army? So there are all kinds of big issues, sort of challenges. But I mean, I think so. It's not so much, as it were, who can win. I mean, for me, the sort of the interesting question is, can Putin or, as it were, can state nationalism prevent the Navalny-style ethnic nationalism bandwagon? And I think that's really hard. I mean, and particularly at a time in which sort of Putin himself isn't being especially effective, then they may hope for some kind of little temporary bump with Sochi if it all goes well and there's lots of medals and national anthems being played and so forth. But in the long term, unfortunately, it's really hard to actually beat that kind of ethnic nationalism.
Now, this isn't happening. This phenomenon is not happening just in Russia. We see a rise in xenophobic sentiment and nativist sentiment all over right now. You see it in Western Europe. You see it in the UK. You see it in the United States. And a lot of this is a negative response to the pressures of globalization. It's a negative response to the pressures of the world that we live in right now. And one of the paradoxes of all of this is, you know, globalization is a byproduct of increased global interdependence. And this causes a rise of nationalism. But at the same time, increased globalization and interdependence diminishes the capacity of states to be able to manage this. So at the time when there's demands on the state to be more assertive, the state is actually limited. Now, if you look at this in the Russian context, is Russia more equipped or less equipped to deal with this than Western countries? I think I know where you're going to go with that, but
let me throw it. I mean, I agree that globalization is one of the sort of factors behind this sort of broad move towards sort of nativist sentiment, as you put it. But I would actually throw in one additional sort of complicating factor, which is financial pressures.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think, you know, we love globalization when it just simply means cheap goods. Mm-hmm. And being able to go on holiday in places. On the other hand, when it suddenly means, you know, perceived unemployment at home, when it means that, I mean, again, if you're looking at the sort of West European thing, there's some sense of, oh my gosh, these foreigners are going to come and drain our social services budget dry, and such, like, however false that those assumptions may be. So I think it's that combination of globalization and financial squeeze which makes it particularly a problem for Russia. Because Russia's facing a particular financial squeeze, and more to the point, will continue to do so for some time. So I mean, is Russia better placed or worse placed to deal with it? To be honest, I would say it's worse placed, precisely because of the challenges of having, you know, it's not just a case of they need Tajiks for the building sites and they need, you know, Ingushetians for the army and such like. It's also, you know, we still have to remember that not only is the Russian Federation precisely that, a federation. Okay, it's not really a federation as we think of it. But nonetheless, but the whole point it is a multi-ethnic state. You know, if one just simply looks at the problem of the United Kingdom in holding on to Scotland these days, who are, you know, they are the same colour as the English. They speak the same language, essentially, as the English. They have far, far more historical ties to the English. But nonetheless, there are tensions there. So let alone how Russians and others deal with each other. But also, the historical experience of the Tsarist Empire, and particularly the Soviet Union, was precisely to interconnect, was to build interconnections that it's very hard to disconnect from. So, I mean, I think this is why, in this respect, perversely, Putin is much better than Navalny for Russia's future, in the sense of Putin's effort to build a Russian state nationalism, however much it may have been sort of founded on some often quite ghastly or stupid decisions, whether it's, you know, wars in Chechnya, massive continued military expenditure, etc., you know, throwing weight around internationally. But nonetheless, his attempt to build a Russian state nationalism that transcended ethnic lines actually offered much more hope for the future of the Russian Federation than an ethnic Russian nationalism, which just has no real rationale to it.
And I would add a caveat to that, just one caveat to that, is unless Navalny is able to turn his ethnic nationalism into something closer to my favorite phrase, civic patriotism.
Unless, absolutely. I mean, in
because
this,
his language is very civic. It's very, he uses that word over and over and over again. But it's never made this, it's never made this turn. It's like clinging to this ethnic Russian nationalism with this civic element, sort of like, I think you or Sean put it this way once, democracy, but just for Russians. Right. But I think this is it.
I mean, politics is always about the art of the control of the imagination, of the public imagination. And in this respect, I mean, it's funny, the same way as there are two Lenins. There was Lenin the idealist and Lenin the ruthless pragmatist. And ultimately, it was Lenin the ruthless pragmatist who won. In some ways, there are two Navalnys. There is Navalny, the ethnic Russian nationalist and elitist, who clearly, you know, has no problem, frankly, with a small proportion of people owning large amounts of money, so long as they acquired that money honestly. And then there is Navalny, the a proponent of key civic values. We remain to see that the danger is that in order to get to power, in order to win wider constituencies and also make himself unthreatening to the existing elite, Navalny, the ethnic Russian nationalist and friend of the rich, wins and has to sacrifice Navalny, the civic patriot. Mm.
All right. Well, Navalny just keeps getting compared to Lenin. I wonder how he would feel about that. In a few moments,
how either of them would.
In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion of the wild ride 2013 has been, and take a look at what we may expect in the coming year as well. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Указ о помиловании Михаила Ходорковского подписан.
Героем новостей сегодня стал, конечно, Михаил Ходорковский.
Я только 36 часов назад получил
сегодня на свободу вышли участницы скандально известной группы «Пусси Райт». Надежда Толокольникова,
участница подгруппы «Пусси Райт».
A discussion of 2013 wouldn't be complete without talking about what I like to call Russia's culture wars. The LGBT issue is part of this. So is how the society reacted to the whole Pussy Riot phenomenon. Conflicts between traditional values and progressive modernism, if you will, aren't unique to Russia, again. But in Russia, they are taking on a very specific tone. Sometimes it's ugly and deeply disturbing, as in the case of the violent attacks against gays we witnessed this year. And sometimes, let's face it, it's been downright hilarious. I mean, who can forget Ksenia Sobchak's virtuoso performance on Dozh TV back in August? As I wrote at the time, as a culture marker, this thing was pure gold. Let's listen to a clip from that interview.
I came in for questioning. The investigator was a young man of 32, a serious-looking man sitting across the desk from me wearing a blue shirt. He asked about my first name, my last name, my place of work. And then his first question literally was, where did you learn that Yelena Mizulina takes a negative attitude toward oral sex and is going to legally ban it?
I hope no minors were listening. That's just a little context here. That was Sobchak speaking to Dozh TV right after she had been interrogated. Because after the State Duma passed a law banning non-traditional sexual relations that was championed by this Duma deputy, Elena Mizulina, Sobchak tweeted that appears she's going to ban oral sex because what, in fact, are non-traditional sexual relations? She was interrogated about this, and then she went on Dozh TV and spilled the beans about what went on in the entire interrogation. It was one of the most hilarious interviews I ever watched. But what this pointed to was, again, it was a cultural marker because this was public. This is one of the things that was actually discussed in serious forums in Russia this year. This was what public discourse had come to. So you have the ugly side of the culture war. You have the absurd side of it. And is anybody winning this thing? If you had to summarize the culture wars in 2014, is anybody winning this thing?
No. It's interesting because on the one hand, you know, that was a splendid example of Ksenia Sobchak being able to sort of lampoon the po-faced, sort of self-proclaimed guardians of traditional values. But then one could also say it's the same Sobchak who in an interview with Pussy Riot just a couple of days back completely trivialized them, what they stood for, seemed to be more interested in talking about their eyebrows and who's prettiest than anything sensible. I think, again, for me, these cultural wars, it will be tempting to fit them into this grand narrative of, you know, a new generation rising or whatever. But again, I see this as much more a symptom of the internal crises within Russia, within both the Russian political system, but also sort of Russia's notion of what Russia is. I mean, the very fact that it's, you know, that the whole campaign was talking about non-traditional sexual relations, the key word there is not sexual but traditional. There is a sense of, and again, this is a sort of the kind of classic response to crisis and pressure and a sense of being assailed by the modern world, that people try to recreate a past that probably never, ever existed. Mm-hmm. And different people are trying to kind of point to different things. I mean, you know, one could just as easily say that this is about an attempt to try and define what kind of a country Russia should be. You know, is it a Western-type country? Because people have a notion that West means Holland, and people, everyone sort of free love and marijuana or whatever. Is it a historically Russian culture? And again, you know, that's open to all kinds of definitions. Is it something new? No one really knows. These are wars that are not won in the sense of one side wins the battle, and that's it. Instead, these are struggles to define. They're struggles to define what kind of a country people want to be in. And the point is that no one really has a clear sense. I mean, many of the people who, for example, supported Pussy Riot didn't do so because they supported LGBT issues. Mm-hmm. Didn't do so because they necessarily liked the music, but just simply because, well, the state has clamped down on these people and therefore we have to protect them. Often these things actually act as synecdoches. They act as way, you know, they gather onto themselves all kind of additional meanings that are actually far, far more important.
Do you see this intensifying or ebbing in the coming year?
I think it's intensifying, precisely.
It will continue
because,
to intensify.
Yeah, exactly. And in many ways, wonderfully, because I think it'll provide us with all kinds of new ridiculousnesses. Mm. But you know, seriously, I think it's exactly because Russia still hasn't gone through that sort of period of true soul searching to actually identify what kind of a country it's going to be. Its entire history is one of happenstance and external pressure. But you know, not taking this as a too historical perspective, but certainly sort of Putin has presided over a maintenance of much that is Soviet, admixed with much that is capitalist. And it only worked while it was glued together by vast amounts of hydrocarbon cash. Now that the cash is running out, we're once again seeing these kind of challenges, just as the Soviet Union was a strange syncretic mix of modern ideology and ancient nationalism. Mm-hmm. I still think that whenever we have these periods political and economic crisis, we will also see that social dimension, and I don't see that going away.
So we can expect more of this in the coming year. And as the year wrapped up, of course, the big news, of course, was the release of Mikhail Khodorkovsky and the release of Nadezhda Telekonikova and Maria Alyukina of Pussy Riot. And I want to play one clip from each of them, and we'll talk about what post-prison life we may expect from these three people. Let's listen to those clips.
If you ask me whether I would personally go to war, I would, to fight for the North Caucasus. It's our land. We conquered it. In today's world, there's no unconquered land left. All of it at some point has been conquered by somebody. The North Caucasus has been conquered by us.
For us, the punk prayer in the Christ the Savior Cathedral is not very important anymore. We are different people now. We live through a long life in prison. It is a totally different reality from the one you live. And this common experience unites us now much more than our joint participation in the punk prayer in the Christ the Savior Cathedral.
Now, I chose those two clips for a reason, those specific two clips. Khodorkovsky is saying something very surprising here. He's saying, yeah, I'd go fight to keep the North Caucasus in Russia. It's our territory. We conquered it. I called this kind of Khodorkovsky's Solzhenitsyn moment, you know, because this caused a lot of hand-wringing among Russian liberals when Khodorkovsky said this. And as you've pointed out in the podcast in the past, there's Khodorkovsky the symbol and there's Khodorkovsky the man. Well, now that Khodorkovsky's out of jail, it's Khodorkovsky the man. The symbolic aspect is going to diminish increasingly over time. Likewise, I chose that Pussy Riot clip from Nadezhda Telekonikova speaking at a press conference today. We're saying, look, what we did in Christ the Savior Cathedral isn't really all that important anymore. Where do you see these two powerful symbols going after now being released from prison and to extent losing a lot of their symbolic power?
Yeah, and I think also we have to realize that these are two very different symbols. I mean, Pussy Riot, I wish them all the best, but I can't say that I've ever really regarded them as important in their own right. They were significant because of how the state responded, because of the extent to which the state was being pushed by the Russian Orthodox Church, and because of the way that that became a catalyst for all kinds of wider discussions about.
But the way they carried themselves during that ordeal did win over a lot of people.
It won over a lot of the people who probably were basically already won over. And again, I mean, the point is they had that moment of power and fame precisely because they were, you know, being put on trial and then being put in prison. It's hard to see them in 3 months' time still having much traction. Yeah, at the moment they're being interviewed because they're only just out, they're new, they're fresh.
They're starting an NGO to help prisoners' rights. They say they want to cooperate with Khodorkovsky and Navalny, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. But
I'm sure they will do useful things. And I'm not in any way trying to sort of do them down, but I mean, I think, you know, there are many extraordinarily useful and effective NGOs still operating within Russia. That does not make them pivotal creatures. Mm. Khodorkovsky is very, very different. Mm-hmm. I mean, apart from the fact that $2 billion makes you very, very different. But, you know, he has had 10 years in prison. You know, he really has paid his price, and he has this extraordinarily interesting trajectory of having been an oligarch who, even if he was a cleaner oligarch, but nonetheless, you know, did the kind of things that people did to become vastly rich in the 1990s, which rightly wins them the opprobrium of most Russians, and yet who has been through this conversion almost, it seems, within prison. You know, we wait and see how far it lasts, you know, how much time in the spas of Switzerland, whether it washes away or all this conversion. But nonetheless, you know, he seems to have definitely acquired a much more of a political but also economic agenda. So in a way, I think Khodorkovsky, both in terms of his importance as a symbol, but also just simply his ability to actually do something, is an order of magnitude different. Mm-hmm.
Did he just have his Solzhenitsyn moment, though, where he's going to become divisive among the liberal opposition as Solzhenitsyn was? Because this comment about the North Caucasus kind of shocked me, to be honest. I didn't expect to hear this coming out of Khodorkovsky's mouth.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting parallel. I mean, you're absolutely right that Khodorkovsky in prison was something that, upon, you know, was a symbol on whom everyone could lay what they wanted to see. I mean, saints and heroes are often best when they're conveniently dead or silent, because exactly they can be everything that you want them to be. But then again, I mean, fighting to keep the North Caucasus in Russia, I mean, is that so different, for example, from what Navalny feels? I mean, Navalny's main problem is that...
No, but Navalny never had the halo.
Paying for them.
Navalny never had the halo that Khodorkovsky had.
Mm, but if we're talking about sort of divisiveness, I mean, let's face it, if you are a true liberal, let the North Caucasus go their own way, etc., you are opposed clearly to the Putin regime. Mm-hmm. And probably any opposition figure is better than that. In this respect, I mean, actually, I mean, Khodorkovsky may well be divisive. I mean, he claims he doesn't want to get involved in politics, but again, you cannot not, even if you're just simply supporting civic purposes, unless he just completely, decides to spend his life on a beach somewhere, or buying a bigger yacht than Abramovich or whatever, then, essentially, he is going to have a political weight whether he likes it or not. My thought is actually he fits quite at the moment quite conveniently within the Navalny-ish stream. Mm-hmm. Now, that could be a strength for the both of them. If mm-hmm. you know, Navalny might become Hodorkovsky's vicar on Earth, and you know, going and doing the actual sort of work while sort of, you know, Hodorkovsky remains this sort of symbolic. Or it could actually be that the two of them will end up competing
mm-hmm.
For the same kind of slice of the Russian potential anti-Putin vote. It remains to be seen, but I think what is clear, though, is exactly that Khodorkovsky cannot be neatly compartmentalized as an anti-Putin figure, full stop. He is also four things, and one of them is precisely that he seems to be willing to espouse, at the very least, Russian state nationalism, and we wait and see if there's a dimension of ethnic Russian nationalism, too.
Okay, well, we're pressing up against time now, and we got to get to our predictions, don't we? At the outset, you characterized the year as bits and pieces, which I thought was apt. I kind of think of this year as a holding pattern. We have a regime that can't capture its past glory, but nothing strong enough to remove it. You have a new Russia waiting to be born, a new generation coming up with different values, but an old Russia that's still there and still very powerful in presence. So we're in this holding pattern. Do you see the holding pattern continuing into 2014, or do you see this breaking at some? Are we getting to a point where we're going to hit a tipping point? Or
it's
what
difficult.
Do you see happening?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, precisely because, you know, my view is that this is a brittle situation. It becomes very hard because it's exactly that the pressure will come from without. To me, I don't see that actually Putin himself is going to do something dramatic that'll change the situation. So really, it's just a question of, well, okay, is that kick on the door that'll bring it down going to come? And I would see that coming from one of three things. One is just a crisis, disaster in Sochi, a sudden and unexpected dramatic collapse of the economic system, you know, a major bank goes belly up or something like that. But, you know, the unexpected situation that challenges not just the legitimacy, but the capacity of the Putin regime. And that can always happen. There can always be a disaster and, you know, another nuclear plant goes wrong.
Right.
Secondly is if Navalny or the opposition, but really that means Navalny, get their act together and are able to pose some kind of serious challenge.
With the help of part of the elite.
With the help, with the help of part of the elite. So, I mean, that could mean either effectively beginning to sort of party structure, beginning to capture part of, and this is the most unlikely outcome, part of the Communist Party's machine, whatever. But basically, Navalny suddenly beginning to become an active rather than passive challenger. Third thing is the pressure comes from the elite. The people decide that precisely because the situation is in what Gorbachev would call a pre-crisis, that they really need to get rid of Putin and put someone else in place. So I think it's three potentials, but they all come from outside the Kremlin.
And whatever it is, we'll be watching. And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, Mark.
My pleasure. Happy New Year.
You too. I'd also like to thank our superhuman producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical Bot podcast will not appear next week. We'd like to wish everyone a happy new year, and we'll see you all again in 2014. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.